can snow, it's snowing.
The wind is blowing, but I can weather the storm. What do I care how much it may storm? I've got my love to keep me warm. I can't remember.
Okay, so I am here with Isabel Wilkerson, who is most recently the author of The Warmth of Other Suns. Isabel, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
I wanted to, first of all, just jump right into this. I wanted to ask about one of the key pieces of conflict relating to the Great Migration that fascinated me. You point out that the old timers, meaning the African Americans who had lived in the Northern Territories before the Great Migration, were harder on the influx of new African American migrants moving into the northern areas than almost anybody else. The Chicago Defender has this list of do's and don'ts,
yes.
The endless articles about what you're supposed to do as a new immigrant. I'm curious, based on your research, to what degree this kind of conflict, what effect did this have on progress that came later in the 1960s? Did this deter efforts at unity? I mean, you kind of get into it in the book, but I wanted to sort of see if your research led to other areas here.
I think that it was generally a low-grade competition, rivalry, and maybe resentment, and which really grew out of fear.
Yeah.
It grew out of an insecurity because the people who were already there in the North were small in number. They had been pioneers from way back, and they'd finally established themselves in these often hostile and alienating cities. And the arrival of basically country cousins,
yeah,
in huge waves to the big cities, you know, obviously raised questions for them about what was going to happen with them. What was going to happen with the, you know, this perfectly balanced, well-honed alchemy that they created with the, you know, the majority of people in these big cities. And they felt embarrassed by them. They felt shame. They felt resentment. And they often didn't want to be anything, be around them. I must point out, though, that while they were most likely to be resentful of them and to maybe have sneeringly judgmental of them, they were not the ones who actually were hurting them physically in the same ways that others were. I mean, others, when they moved out into other neighborhoods, when they arrived in these big cities, that was when they might be firebombed because they were going into a neighborhood where they were not welcome. So the people who were there, it was more sort of an insider resentment and fear that's very different, but actually was just as painful to the people who were arriving. Because the people who were arriving were like people arriving from any faraway place to a new land that they hoped would be better. And they felt really hurt by that, very, very hurt. And it actually limited their ability to move about. They couldn't join certain churches. So it was an in-group stratification that is kind of an inside baseball thing, but kind of human nature too. It's about survival.
It also seems to me to be about class divide, and that's one aspect of, you know, 20th century black history that we really don't discuss. I guess just going back to the original question of whether an internal class struggle like this, I mean, did it really have a serious deterrent upon advancement? Or?
I think it did in the beginning stages. You know, while the people were new and you know, kind of untutored into the ways of the North, the people were pretty much rejected,
yeah,
and not welcome. Over time, like every immigrant group that's ever come in, and they were not immigrants in the true sense of the word because they were born in the United States, they were American citizens, and they went to another region in order to realize the rights that they were born to, they essentially acted as any immigrant would, and so they looked up to the people who were there, and they found that it was difficult for them to make that adjustment. But once they did make the adjustment, they in turn would become as sneeringly judgmental of the people coming behind them. It's,
yeah,
just sort of this wave of... It's just the way human beings think. Ultimately, though, the larger forces would intrude, and as a group, they found themselves all hemmed in by the larger economy that didn't really want any of them. And I wouldn't say that it impeded progress to that degree. There were rivalries in every group. I think that it certainly didn't help, and it was very disheartening to the people when they first arrived.
Yeah.
It is, because you're rejected by your own people. It's very painful.
Instead of having, you know, kind of a polarization effect to really fight a lot of the racism that was going down, and the firebombing, the Cicero,
exactly,
riots you made.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, this is very interesting because you do cite this 1965 census survey in which it was revealed that a lot of the migrants moving in had more education, equal sometimes, but often more education than the native white northerners.
Exactly,
who were there.
Which is astounding.
Yeah.
I mean, when I saw that, it was just hard to believe. But part of it is remembering the era that we're talking about. We're talking about an era in which many of the people were children of the Depression, and many of them had hard lives no matter where they were. Many of them were the children or actual immigrants from other places. So, you know, the early part of the 20th century was not a time of great enlightenment overall, unfortunately. So life was hard for everybody, but how ironic, actually, that the people who came up in this great migration were actually slightly better educated when it came to the numbers. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not getting to the quality, because the quality of education in the South was markedly, you know, unequal, clearly. But they had put in the time, they'd gone as far as they could, and then they left finally for hopefully a better life in the North and the West. But it's interesting that the mythology and the misconceptions about these people, once I began to discover them, I found that became a big focus of the work that I hadn't anticipated.
Yeah. Well, what's also interesting, I mean, just to kind of compare this education question back to the initial thread here, which was, well, if these people are better educated than the native white Northerners, so to speak, then why would they be kind of sneering down? That's I guess that was my big question. Or did this really kind of become phased out by 1965?
Well, one of the things is that when they arrived, you're thinking about when they arrived and what they were leaving.
Yeah.
What they were leaving was a caste system in which their every move was dictated by the laws of Jim Crow.
Sure.
So that we had examples where, you know, in Birmingham, a black person and a white person couldn't play checkers together. There were, you know, black elevators and white elevators. I mean, every single aspect of that. There's even one place where blacks and whites could not take the same staircase in the same building where they were all working. I mean, how do you even do the logistics of that?
The Jacksonville bus terminal that was completely segregated, that blew my mind. I didn't even know about that.
No, and even to the point where the cocktail lounges were separate. They had two of those, lest the racists brush elbows over a martini.
Do you know what happened to that bus terminal? Because I was trying to figure this out. It fascinated
me.
Well,
it was interesting. It was written in the Wall Street Journal. Yeah. It was 1958,
which
was not that long ago when you think about recent history. And obviously that would have been dismantled. I mean, obviously all those things would have gone the way of all the white and colored signs that evaporated after the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
So, you know,
But they had just constructed that terminal.
They had just constructed
it. And the question is they're going to have to adapt that terminal. So is it a case like, for example, you know, Berlin, they have two zoos, one for West Berlin and one for East Berlin. Is that what they ended up doing in that terminal? Do you know? Or?
Well, I mean, in that terminal, they would have had to get rid of all of the white and black. All the segregation would have to go. I mean,
they still have the basic architecture. You know what
they
I mean?
Would have, I don't know what has happened with the architecture.
Yeah.
That's a really good question.
Yeah.
I haven't been to
Okay, I didn't know.
What I found know. That, I found that through my research, and it was actual story in the Wall Street Journal that was astounding to me, and so I made reference to it because it was one more example of the extreme measures that they went to in order to keep the races separate. What a waste for everybody, black and white.
Yeah, exactly. Well, in 1944, George Starling made serious efforts in Florida to get better wages for the tangerine pickers. And I'm curious, why did George stand up in a way that other workers didn't? I mean, you do mention debt peonage, which men were charged with vagrancy if they and they were forced to labor for several weeks' pay if they were caught being a vagrant and they didn't have the money to pay. And then this led into a sort of neo-slavery, as you say. But there was also a wartime labor shortage, which leads me to say, well, you know, George here is very clear about going ahead and standing up for workers' rights. Why wasn't that more widespread? Was it just his temperament, or was it the times?
Well, it was interesting that actually that debt peonage, when it comes to the vagrancy laws, they could be applied for any given reason. There was a case where one of the people he had worked with was actually arrested on a Saturday after he had worked the whole week.
Yeah.
So you didn't even have to be on the street. He actually was arrested because the Grove owners needed people out there picking, and they could just, for whatever reason, the sheriff could go and just take these people. So you're absolutely right that these were extremely dangerous times. It's more dangerous than we can even imagine now. The South has never been friendly toward unions, and essentially what he was doing was creating a union by organizing the pickers to not pick, basically work stoppages, unless they got an extra nickel for a box of tangerines.
Yeah.
And I think that partly is he had been exposed to the North. He had relatives who were in the North, he had aunts who were in New York, so he had a chance to see what the possibilities were, which was also the way that this great migration affected North and South. It implanted in the minds of those who stayed the idea that there was another way to live. Once you've been exposed to that, it's hard to go back. That was one of the things that happened. I mean, he also went to Detroit, as you know, at a certain point he goes to Detroit. And it's when he returns from the North that he has less patience for the caste system that he's under. And he was kind of emboldened as a result of it. Another thing is that he also had some college education, which is interesting, speaking about the stratification. And he was able to see the unfairness, and it just grated on him. And he could see that during the wartime there was this great need for labor, and there was no one else to pick. I mean, most of the great pickers were off to war, and there were very few people there. Basically, the grove owners were in a pickle. I mean, they were essentially needing labor, and the labor was limited. They didn't have their pick of whoever they wanted, and he recognized that as a weakness on their part, and he tried to exploit that by trying to get more money for the pickers, who were already working in such really harsh, dangerous circumstances. I mean, they were having to climb into 40-foot trees that would fall and break a limb. I mean, there was no workers' compensation. It was it almost feels like feudal times. Yeah. It's like another era, but it was not that long ago. So the reasons why he did it, I would say, first of all, he could see that there was a great need for the work, but not enough workers, so that gave them more power. But also was making the sheriff and other people go and arrest these people for vagrancy, even if they were in their own homes, because they needed the workers. So this odd combination of explosive moment in Florida and other parts of the South, where the workers, having been repressed for so long, recognized that they might have a little bit more power and tried to act on it. But ultimately, as comes clear in the book, he ends up having to flee for his life, essentially, and he heads to New York, 1945.
Well, this also leads me to ask you about one observation you make later in the book, Dearborn, which is across from Detroit. I mean, in the mid-1950s, it was a huge hub for white flight. And as you point out, in the 2000 census, the black population of Dearborn is now 1%. So it looks to me like things really don't change much. So this question of fleeing or migration, it's almost as if even if you do go up to the North, where things are a little bit clearly more civilized, you don't have a caste system up there, but you still have this incredible fragmentation and this incredible fear. You know, I mean, obviously there was some progress made, but clearly some things still stay the same.
Well, it depends on how you measure progress. I mean, from the perspective of the people who left, just leaving was an achievement. I mean, just to be able to get out, because there were times where, as we talked about the peonage, where they could arrest people in their own homes if they weren't working on a Saturday, even though they had worked the whole week. I mean, that meant that you just basically had no rights. And as the people were trying to leave, they would arrest them on the railroad platforms. They would board the trains and arrest people wholesale for the same reasons that we've described. They would say that you owe money to the planter to whom you've been working, or anybody that they could say. They didn't have to have a reason. And so that meant that they had no rights. So just getting out, in some ways, was its own achievement. That's one way of looking at it. The other thing is that when you look at the experiences of the people once they got there, they were not looking to, you know, run Fortune 500 companies or, you know, own big skyscrapers. They just wanted to be able to, you know, get their kids in good schools, be able to get paid a fair wage for their work, be able to own a home, the basic American things that would drive any immigrant to leave a repressive place, the only place they'd ever known, for some place different that might be better. So in some ways, I mean, I view the human motivation as important as the actual, whatever measurable success you might have. And there are tremendous successes as a result. I mean, the thing about it is, when you look at a Dearborn, Michigan, or you look at many of the inner city, what are called ghettos to this day, those are not the result of the Great Migration. Those are the result of the reaction to the Great Migration. That's a totally different thing.
Yeah.
That's a totally different thing. Sure. And what other people do as a result of the fact that you have this influx of people is not the same as having an influx of people looking to find some kind of better life based, because in some ways this was a defection from the South. It wasn't just a migration. It wasn't people relocating for a job. This was in some ways political asylum that these people were seeking. And how do you respond to the arrival of all of these people? How do the cities respond? The cities responded by with people fleeing and creating their own alternative communities and not letting them in. And that's one of the results of the reaction to it.
But this also leads me, while we're on the subject of white flight, I mean, when Ida Mae Gladney's family bought their home in Chicago, she discovered, literally, that a white family, a home had disappeared. They had moved the home, physically moved the home. And then you write right after that, within weeks of the disappearing house, moving vans clogged Colfax Street. I'm wondering why white flight afflicted the South Shore and even the Hyde Park neighborhoods in 1967 so rapidly. I mean, were you able to determine also if any white families stayed? I mean, I don't believe every white person left, but it is nevertheless troubling that it hit that community and also Dearborn in Michigan in general. I mean,
the vast, vast majority. I mean, these neighborhoods are, in fact, the cities that are talked about here in this book, there's actually a reference to what's called hypersegregation. And the places that had the hypersegregation, which meant that things were so segregated as to be almost completely all black or all white neighborhoods, were primarily in the receiving cities of the Great Migration, meaning the cities did not want them there, and the people who were there already, whatever their other ethnicity might have been, fled and left such extreme segregation that you have neighborhoods such as hers that are pretty much almost completely black.
Yeah. But Ida Mae did buy it from an Italian.
Yeah, she did. Yeah, I mean,
clearly, you know, not everybody was you know, uncomfortable about
these
developments.
Yeah. They were leaving.
But, I mean, I'm wondering, you know, to what degree did you try to look into more multicultural results of the Great Migration, where, in fact, it wasn't necessarily, white flight didn't result, obviously, in every single case. I mean, if a less fearful migration in response to the Great Migration occurred, did you find anything
You remember, have to put ourselves back in the time frame that we're talking about.
Sure.
So we're not talking about 2010.
Sure.
We're talking about 1967, when it was a totally different world. And you're talking about a totally different generation of blacks and whites. So at that time, there was a great deal of fear among the people who were there, the whites, who were fearful of what were going to happen to their neighborhoods. And they didn't necessarily want to leave their neighborhoods, but fear bred fear. And one of the great tragedies of the 20th century is that the people who were doing the leaving were often exactly like the people that they were leaving. They were often people of the land, people who had worked the land in their old homes, had left places of repression for various reasons, left caste systems that left them with very little maneuvering room in order to thrive, and all left and came a far, far, far distance in order to find themselves in these alienating, hostile, often forbidding cities. They were the exact same people, except some of them were from Eastern Europe and from Southern Europe, or from parts of Asia, or from parts of Central or South America, and others were from the southern region of the United States, and they looked different. They were the exact same people, but some people were allowed to join unions. Other people, those from the South, the blacks from the South, were often brought in as strike breakers. There were so many ways that they were torn asunder and divided that it's one of the great tragedies that these people who might have been the best of friends ended up being on opposite sides of a racial divide that led to this hypersegregation we're talking about, that led to these communities that often were where things got so explosive that there would be mobs of people who would firebomb a house when black people tried to move in. So there's a great deal of misunderstanding and a sort of internal stratification even within these cities. So this is not about people who were good or people who were bad. This is about human reaction to fear. All of them fearful that their tenuous hold on life in this new world might be threatened if other people moved in that they had been raised or had grown to be fearful of. And that was what happened in all these cities. Unfortunately, there are not a lot of happy stories that come out of that. Yeah. It's different now. We're no longer in 1967 or 1953. And the children of these people have had the opportunity to perhaps grow and learn from the mistakes that were made by this previous generation.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to that particular period. I mean, you quote the Kerner Report authors, they wrote of the post-Martin Luther King assassination riots. And they said that almost 74% of the rioters were brought up in the North, that they were frustrated Northerners who appeared to be seeking fuller participation in the social order and the material enjoyed by the majority of American citizens. Is it as simple as that? Why such great violence coming more from the North as opposed to the South?
Well, we're talking about people who were in the so-called New World, who were in the place of the land of dreams. In other words, life was not likely to get any better in this country except than in the North if you were African American. So they had fled the caste system and they found themselves in this new world, which was supposed to be better, and the children found that it was not.
And they had reached a certain tipping point that they needed to throttle.
Exactly.
Got
and
it.
It didn't take much to tip them over because they were the ones who, they didn't have the same level of patience. In other words, the immigrant is different from the children of a child of an immigrant. Yeah. The immigrant is used to suffering and sacrifice and you know, discomfort.
Yes.
They have more limited expectations about what life will be. They've already lived a part of their lives and there's nothing they can do about it. They're willing to make, to sort of step back and take more of the pain and the hurt because that's what they've been accustomed to. The children don't feel that way. The children were Northerners.
Yes.
Or the children of other immigrants. I mean, in Boston, for example, where you have stratification among the Irish. You have lace curtain Irish and you have South Boston Irish.
Yeah.
You have working class Irish. You have Irish who've gotten involved in gangs. I mean, you have the variety of all that. And that's because if in the new world life is not going well for the children, they're going to act out.
Yeah.
And they're going to show their displeasure and their frustration, and it comes out.
Particularly when they're raised with different values.
Different expectations because
yeah.
they're raised in the place where things are supposed to be the land of dreams, the land of milk and honey.
Yeah.
And where is the milk? Where is the honey?
Yeah.
And they're not seeing it.
Yeah. I wanted to basically bring up the New York Times book review of your book by David Oshinsky. He suggested that you ignored Nicholas Lemon's The Promised Land. That book rather famously pointed to considerable poverty that arose towards those who migrated northwards. Based off of reading your book and talking to you, you certainly have a very optimistic, justifiably optimistic view of what happened during the 20th century. But I'm curious why poverty was not as pursued. I mean, in the index, there isn't even an index entry for poverty. I was really surprised by that. So why did you kind of not really delve into poverty? Like, did you feel the Lemon book already did that, or what of this?
Well, first of all, you know, I was a reporter for the Times for years and
yes.
years and years, and I won a Pulitzer Prize for my coverage of that. So I've dealt with that. I've contributed a great deal in my own career to the understanding of the role of poverty in the U.S. So I've dealt with that.
Yeah.
I don't consider the book to be either optimistic or pessimistic because there is a lot of ugliness on all sides in the book. And there's a lot of, I mean, human beings are fascinating creatures. And this is a human story about what human beings do under certain circumstances. But several things. One is there's so much literature about poverty in the U.S. There's no Grapes of Wrath for this great migration. There was none. None.
Yeah.
So journalists tend to like to write, at least I will say as a journalist, I like to write about things that have not been written about. I'm not going to go and write what other people have written, because then what is the point of repeating what other people have written, or repeating my own work? I mean, I've written about the underclass.
You hit the same notes, essentially, when you're doing the coverage, if you were to focus exclusively on poverty.
The other thing is that the story of the Great Migration is not the story of poverty.
Well, what is it the story of, exactly, then?
It's the story of, because if you think about it, if black unemployment is 10%, that means 90% of African Americans work.
Yeah.
So why would you have 10% of anything driving the entire story of something? And the thing with the migration is that, I mean, as I started to look into it, I discovered so much that I didn't know. For example, the idea that the majority of these people actually were married and remain married. The majority of these people actually were raising their children in two-parent households. So that the conventional wisdom that all of us have grown up with actually is not supported by the data. And the data doesn't come from me at all.
Yeah.
This is with, you know, you read from the Kerner Commission. That's not coming from me.
Yeah.
I didn't do that research. That research was done by sociologists and economists and others who are much better suited to understanding that data than I am. I read that in order to be able to understand it, and all of that put in context what I was discovering in my interviews. And I interviewed over 1,200 people.
Yeah.
And also that the majority of the people who had migrated, actually, you know, you're talking about poverty, the majority of them actually in the aggregate made more money more money than the people who were in the North already. That's astounding. That is the exact opposite of everything we've ever been told about the Great Migration, the exact opposite. And that's not coming from me. That's coming from preeminent sociologists who know way more about this and, you know, study the census data, and not one, but an entire field of people who do nothing but look at the census data. So it's not coming from me.
Yeah. But if the 1965 study is saying, hey, these folks were more educated, the other statistic that is cited in that study is what you're saying, that they worked very hard and avoided poverty more than the northern white population.
Northern black.
Northern black, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, my apologies. Then why then would such a story be swept under a rug? I mean, that's a big question.
You'd have to ask the people who did the sweeping.
Yeah.
I did the research and I looked, at a certain point I was reading a book a day.
Yeah.
Wow. I was reading a book a day. I actually had so many journal articles coming out of JSTOR, thank goodness, for JSTOR, which is a database that allows us to be able to look at these old, at the journal articles going all the way back to 1883. I left no stone unturned trying to understand what is it that makes a person do such a thing as to leave the only place they ever known, the only place where all their family, friends, kin, kith are. This is before Skype and cell phones. What would make a person do that?
Yeah.
And I mean, I couldn't believe what I was discovering. I mean, some of the things I had to look at them two and three times to make sure I was reading it properly, because I grew up in a world in which the conventional wisdom was the total opposite of what the data was showing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's astounding. It is absolutely astounding. I mean, it wasn't just one person. It wasn't the 65 study. There was also census. There was a Long and Hanson. There are all these different names. There's Tolney. I mean, name after name after name. Quietly, doing this research that wasn't getting much attention. And I looked up all of these journal articles, and I could not believe my eyes. I simply couldn't believe it.
In an effort to try to make sure that all three of your stars get a question, I do want to ask about Robert Foster. He developed this interesting gambling habit, let's just say that, largely because blacks were excluded from Vegas. And it took guys like James Arthur Gay to basically get him a room. I'm wondering if you were able to determine why the Sands Hotel was more flexible than all the other hotels in allowing, Bob Foster to get his room.
A lot of it had to do with the personal connections made by people who were coming from other places where they didn't have those same stereotypes or same assumptions. One of the problems that he ran into when he was migrating on that long journey across the desert that got him to California to begin with is that he was rejected by many people before, as he was trying to make his way. But he ran into a very sympathetic couple who happened to be from Illinois. And it just so happened that they at least gave him some hope. They wouldn't let him stay because they felt that they would be ostracized for it and they couldn't take that risk. But it's those personal connections with one individual, just one brave person, one brave white person, who can say, I'm not going to adhere to the caste system that is here because it's not a fair one, it's not helping any of us, it's not right, and I'm going to stand up for it. And so someone took a chance on Jimmy Gay and allowed him to work there, and then that was the one place that was safe. It always takes one person, and it shows you the power of an individual.
Yeah.
All it takes is one person to open up that door and provide a safe haven.
But it also takes the will of someone like Robert Foster. For example, when he gets the Cadillac, I mean, he says, to hell with what people think of me, go on and do what you want to do.
Exactly.
Now, the question, though, is whether it's a question, because at that point in his career, he had a lot of money, and money buys you more ability to make decisions at the table. So the question is was it more money or determination that allowed him to get to that particular spot, or even someone like, Gay, who we were just talking about earlier?
I think that it was probably the determination ultimately, because he lost a ton of money too because he ended up gambling. So I mean, ultimately, it was that determination, that desire for something, almost for approval, for attention, for acceptance by because he had faced so much rejection throughout his life, which is also a very human thing. I mean, just the idea of growing up in the system, the caste system in which he had grown up, being rejected multiple times, and being rejected when he got out to L.A., as we discussed, And he always had this yearning to be accepted, and I don't know that it was ever filled, really. I don't know that there would have been enough money for it, but the money certainly helped him to be able to get access to things he wouldn't have before. But it was that urge to be accepted and to be fully American and experience all the things that it meant to be, you know, a physician, professional, and an achiever in the United States, which had been denied him in so many other ways. I don't know that he ever felt that he'd achieved that, which is kind of sad, actually.
Yeah. I wanted to also ask about the methodology. You get into it at the end of the book. But I was curious about this because, I mean, in corroborating the stories of your three stars, I'm just going to call them stars, I just like that. I'm wondering, what steps did you take to make sure that every single one of their stories was true? I mean, you know, each and every memory is going to be subject to fluidity. I mean, you write that your subjects frequently decline to speculate or press beyond what they recollected. In the case of, like, Bob Foster, who we were just talking about, his departure can, in fact, be corroborated against the Atlanta newspapers, as you have in the notes. But then you have a situation like Ida May, her story of the white farmer who got drunk on Fridays and was saying, I'll kill you all, and shooting randomly at black people. I mean, that's something that you can't corroborate, or can you? I mean, what did you do when you had, like, only one source to go by on a story? I mean, I think the book does a very good job, for the most part, of showing this is the kind of thing that occurred during this time period in this particular place. On the other hand, people's memories are plastic and elastic, and so how did you balance this? Huh?
That'd be hard to forget.
It would be hard to forget. Yeah.
I mean, if a farmer comes around and you have to jump in a bin of corn meal when you're little, and he keeps coming around multiple times, that'd be hard to forget.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, the thing is that the each individual does not have the responsibility of holding up the entire book. So in other words, what I needed from them was not that they remember every single thing that happened to them ever in life. Yeah. All I needed was general examples that were clear cut, that they repeated over and over and over again, over and over and over again, as being seared in their memory. And who you are is your memory. Without your memory, you are no one. Your entire identity is your memory. Everything. People who have Alzheimer's are no longer themselves because they cannot even remember who they were, who their children were. So that is all that you are. And this is a distillation of and a portrait of who these people were. They are their memories. And their memories have value. Their memories have value because the memories of all of our families are based upon what is told down the line through time. Other groups of people have had the opportunity to tell the stories of what happened to them during the Holocaust, what happened to them during the flight from Ireland, what happened to them as they made their way from China. These people's stories have as much value as anyone else's story, and those stories had to be captured before it was too late. These people should have been interviewed in 1938 and 37. As I was listening to them, they should have been interviewed there. I was not around then. Someone should have done it. And the only thing that I can do is to capture it before it's too late. And that's what I did.
Got it. I'm curious if you were very careful, if you received a story from one of your subjects that basically it only flowed one way, meaning a story from them had to be confirmed through the history that you were digging up rather than history supporting the stories. Was that,
you know,
much...
What's interesting is that all the stories that they told, the records were far worse than anything they ever said. Their stories were mild compared to the written record.
Yeah.
The written record of Claude Neal, for example, is about the worst I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah.
It's so bad no one ever asked me about it. And that's written.
Were there any stories that were too terrible to put in the book? Or?
Well, that one was pretty bad.
Yeah.
That was of a man who was essentially... He was lynched in such a way as to be, I can't repeat it.
Yeah.
If you recall,
yeah.
In Florida, 1934. So the written record was far worse than anything they ever told me.
Yeah.
Their stories were mild in comparison.
And
far worse than the things that even though many of the people, the white people in power in the South, were saying themselves.
Yeah. What did you do to get their trust to make sure that you would be able to capture this essential history?
You know, it just took a lot of time. I mean, each of them, you know, had different personalities. They were in different stages of health, which was a bigger challenge than even the trust in a way. They all had varying things pulling at them based upon what their children or grandchildren were doing. So there were a lot of things that had to be negotiated with all of them. Ultimately, I think that By choosing the three of them, I chose people who there was essentially some kind of chemistry where they were willing to talk with me and felt comfortable. And they were also at a certain point in their lives where they were willing to talk. And that made a big difference. That made a big difference in their willingness to talk. And I just, you know, a lot of it comes from time. One thing for sure is that you cannot make an assumption that just because I share some of the background with them that it was automatic, because I come from a migration stream that is the East Coast migration stream, meaning from Georgia, the Carolinas, and Virginia up to Washington, Philadelphia, and ultimately like here to New York. But when I would talk to people who were in a different migration stream, they didn't really, you know, necessarily immediately take to me. I mean, they would ask, well, where are your people from? You know, and if I were, you know, Georgia didn't resonate with people who were from Texas. The food is different, the accents are different, language is different, the names are different. So in a way, there was a lot to overcome, more than one might expect.
Did you require intermediaries or anything like that to kind of get their trust, or was it just kind of gradually working on it one at a time?
That's a really great question. It was sort of gradually earning their trust by, you know, listening, being attentive, you know, sometimes if they, you know, wanted to, you know, I'd take them to a restaurant that they liked. You know, you often they wanted to go to a soul food restaurant. I'm happy to take them there. Ultimately,
you free food.
Yeah, exactly. I could always do that.
Yeah.
You know, ultimately, I had the opportunity to take Ida Mae back to Mississippi, and to be able to, jog her memory even more. You know, even more things came out as she was actually in the land and, you know, recording her over time and having her retell the stories over and over again to try to get a sense of what her experience had been like. And we actually even, you know, passed by some cotton and she went out and wanted to pick the cotton. Now that she didn't have to pick, she almost couldn't help but go out there. And I said to her, you know, is it okay? And she said, this land belongs to somebody else. And she said, well, they're not going to care about what little bit we're going to pick. So she wanted to go out there and do it. So what I'm saying is that, you know, just spending time with them made a big difference. Sometimes just listening, because there was, you know, once you get retired, there aren't a lot of people necessarily around. The kids are out working, grandkids are out in school or whatever. And there's a lot of alone time, and I think that, you know, you become sort of company for them. They start to look forward to it, and then it becomes a good thing.
I'm curious if you gave them any of, you know, notes or drafts of chapters.
Oh, no.
No,
okay. Absolutely not.
Yeah, so
we don't do that journalistically.
Yeah, I was just curious, because, I mean, did any of them ask at all to sort of read? No, they were perfectly happy to do this. Okay.
Well, I mean, I came to them with the history of having been a reporter. Yeah. They could actually see there were things that I might have been writing elsewhere that they could see, you know, so they could see that I was a working journalist. They knew at a certain point when I was teaching at Princeton, they could see that I was teaching at Princeton. So there were, you know, I was a legitimate person, and they knew that, and they never requested that at all. No.
Do you think, just as a final question, that you cap the Great Migration at 1970? Near the end of the book, you have, of course, Sheriff Willis McCall.
Yeah.
In 1971, he's forced by a federal court order to remove a colored waiting room sign. Where are we at now? I mean, are we sort of in the instead of the Great Migration, we're in the Great Settling period? And how long do you think this is going to go?
You know, it's interesting, because I look at this, and I so appreciate that question. Such a great question, because I look, you know, human behavior is so slow moving. You know, I think we're in such a fast paced world that we expect, okay, this is 2010, so we're in the year of whatever, the year of the big recession. You know, 2005, we're in the year of this. You know, each year we think that we're in some different phase, and I think it's so much more slower moving than that. I think that we're still recovering from this huge demographic shift that occurred with the Great Migration and that prompted so many changes demographically throughout the country. You know, the North in some ways is predominantly blue because of the migration of so many people from the South. Think about that.
Yeah.
Certain cities are predictably blue because of the migration of so many of these people. And the South, having lost some of that blueness, you know, is now predictably, even more predictably red. So that, you know, I think we're still living with it. It's hard to say where we will be in 50 years. Where will we be? What is the significance when people have not had the opportunity to really grow up and to know one another?
Yeah.
And we're just beginning to do that.
On the other hand, there is this ongoing issue. I mean, I talked about this with Peniel Joseph. The idea Obama gets elected, we're suddenly in a, quote, post-racial world where suddenly we can't discuss race, or we can't discuss migration, we can't discuss the results of such a tremendous demographic shift. So the question is if, I suppose, there is this kind of silent stigma against talking about this topic. You went ahead and wrote a book on a subject that people didn't want to talk about that did happen. I mean, if we're so if we're not as candid to discuss this, I mean, you know, discussions like this, I hope, help in some form.
Yes.
But the question is why are we so uncomfortable even now to discuss this? I mean, you know, we've got finally a black man as president. We've got progress in some form, and yet it's not over.
Well, I mean, the fact that questions came up in our discussion about the conventional wisdom about who these people were,
yes,
the essential facts of their lives were not known. Even to someone like me, who's been a journalist all my career and grew up as a child of the Great Migration, I did not realize the statistics and the data. I did not know. I did not know. And that means that the majority of us probably do not know what's even happened in the very recent past in our own country. How can we move into a future in which we do understand ourselves better if we don't know where we've come from, if we don't know the essential truth of an entire people in this country? And when we talk about people, I don't mean black people. I mean of people who were coming together in these big cities and torn apart because of the economic structure of the places where they were living. And if we've never dealt with them, really. Have we ever really sat down and understood the facts of what we've even lived through? We want to quickly put it's almost like you've had an argument with a family member, you just want to just not talk about it anymore. And you're not going to get, those conflicts are not resolved. And my goal with this book is that I grew up, in a school where there were many, many people. It was a very diverse school, and many of my best friends were people who happened to have been the children of those who were immigrants. And I never thought about this growing up. It's just that the people, we all had a lot in common. We were kind of embarrassed by the food that our mothers were packing in our lunch boxes because it was different from what the other children were eating. And I realized that, you know, we all have so much more in common. If anything that could come through this is to recognize that we all have so much more in common than we've ever been led to believe. There is nothing essentially different about one human being than another, except that for what the opportunities may be for them, and when you think about North and South, whether there's this frustration over what ended up happening in this place of dreams. What ended up happening? And the goal would be that everyone who reads the story looks at these individual people, these amazing protagonists, amazing individuals in their own right, allowing them to tell their stories and allowing, the reader to put themselves in the mindset of these people, identify with these people. These people do not present themselves as perfect people. They would tell you, I made many mistakes in my life, but leaving the South was not one of them. And so to allow ourselves to relive that history through them, maybe that would help us to understand, what someone in all of our backgrounds sacrificed for us to be here. Because we wouldn't be here if someone hadn't sacrificed. And that would be my goal with the book.
Well, on that very hopeful note, Isabel, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat with you. Let's see if the discussion can continue.
Thank you so much.
Great.
For
Thanks.
Having
Take,
me.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away, I wonder this time where she's gone. I wonder if she's gone to stay. Sunshine.